Welcome, investors, to the Absolute Return Podcast, your source for stock market analysis, global macro musings, and hedge fund investment strategies. Your hosts, Julian Klimochko and Michael Kesslering, aim to bring you the knowledge and analysis you need to become a more intelligent and wealthier investor. This episode is brought to you by Accelerate Financial Technologies. Accelerate, because performance matters. Find out more at accelerateshares.com.
Welcome, ladies and gents, to episode 79 of the Absolute Return Podcast. I am Julian Klimochko.
And I'm Mike Kesslering.
We're finished another week of market activities. It's Friday, July 24th. A number of interesting events, specifically three that we wanted to touch on, covering BACs, M&A, and some interesting index talk. But start off, wanted to chat about Bill Ackman's massive special purpose acquisition company doing a $4 billion IPO. That's right, the largest by far SPAC IPO of all time. We speculate on which companies this SPAC is going to acquire. On to some index news. Tesla reports its first profitable quarter, or its first profitable year, four quarters in a row, and its shares hit a new all-time high, and those four profitable quarters in a row make it eligible to be in the big-time S&P 500 index. But will it actually get added? And lastly, we were talking a bit of M&A, consolidation in the oil patch. Chevron, a huge player in the oil market, they announced a deal to buy Noble for $13 billion. What do shareholders think of this deal? But first, Mike, let's chat about Bill Ackman, or should I call him Bill Spackman? I mean, a huge splash into the blank check space, launching a $4 billion IPO. I guess when Bill Ackman does things, he does them big. Launched a SPAC called Pershing Square Tontine Holdings. And what's super interesting about this SPAC is not only is it $4 billion, and to give you some context, the average SPAC market cap is roughly $350 million. Huge SPAC IPOs have been in the $1 billion range. So this is basically quadruple the biggest that's ever been done. And in addition to that, his investment firm, Pershing Square, is committed to adding an additional $1 to $3 billion on top. So this SPAC could ultimately be as large as $7 billion. And to provide additional context, prior to this Pershing Square Tontine IPO, the entire SPAC market was $44 billion in market cap. So this represents, you know, an increase of about 10% to the entire sector. What type of deal is he going to do with this $4 to $7 billion, or I should say $5 to $7 billion after his investment firm chunks up another a few billion into it? He's targeting very large, profitable private companies that he refers to as, quote, mature unicorn. And as our listeners would know, unicorn is just $1 billion plus private company. Some of these startups that are considering going public, but may consider a SPAC, which are super hot these days, instead of your boring traditional IPO. We're seeing a lot of interesting startups go the SPAC route as opposed to even direct listing like some other startups have done. Some trading news on the deal. It was actually three times oversubscribed, so demand was upwards of $12 billion. And with that demand, and in this market, not surprised to see it trade up. It was up 6.5% on its first day of trading, which meant it was trading about $200 to $300 million north of its cash value, which is pretty significant. Pershing Square will now have about 2 years to strike a deal. So, Mike, which company do you think they'll buy?
I mean, some of the, like, you look at Airbnb, they're looking to go public. There's certain restaurants that are looking to go public as well. I believe we were talking about Shake Shack before the call. But, you know, this is a very interesting situation, especially like you had mentioned with that $1 to $3 billion forward purchase agreement. That means that they could have, you know, $7 billion worth of cash to deploy. This is, they're whale hunting, and there's not many companies that would fit their criteria.
Yeah, it's interesting because we look at it versus other SPACs and they're quadruple the size of the largest. So that really gives them a leg up in terms of targets because they're looking at companies that every single other SPAC couldn't consider because these private companies are too large. So Pershing Square would more so be competing with you know, some of the largest private equity firms out there, because the SPAC with the cash on hand, you can issue more shares. And so in fact, they can be doing a deal that has a pro forma value in kind of the even $20 to $30 billion range. And what buyout firm can do a deal that big? So I think Bill Ackman indicated that there's roughly 150 targets that they would consider in terms of size. I mean, there's not a ton of private companies that are worth more than $10 billion, right?
Yeah, exactly. And I just wanted to go back and look at a little bit of the structure here. As it, right in the name, you have Tontine. And with this structure, you have the Tontine warrants. And I do believe on a previous podcast, when they first came out with their S1, we briefly touched on this structure. But just to go back to it a little bit, this comes back to what a Tontine is a pooled vehicle that really effectively awards dividends to participants who had outlived their co-investors. This is really archaic investment structure from, you know, 80 to 100 years ago that was quite popular for a little while. But really why they went with this sort of warrant structure was looking at a way to incentivize investors to stick around and not redeem for cash and stick around for the business, for the as shareholders for the actual business combination. And so what effectively happens is right now, the warrant coverage, if you got a unit on the IPO or if you purchased one in the market after the IPO, is the warrant coverage is 1/9 of a warrant, so 1/3 of 1/3, with the remaining 2/9 to come after the SPAC closes the business combination. And it really also depends on how many shareholders redeem. If no shareholders redeem, then you just end up with those remaining 2/9. If 50%, for example, redeem, you would end up with an additional 4/9 of a warrant. And so it's a very interesting structure, a little bit of game theory, and really just kind of trying to move away, I guess, from some of the SPAC arbs that really fill out the demand of these IPOs, which is an interesting structure. And it's something that only somebody of Bill Ackman's he's such a popular investor that they knew that demand was going to be strong for this so that they could try something creative.
Yeah, he can drive terms just given his reputation. And this novel structure is really to drive incentives, right? It incentivizes investors not to redeem and stay in the fund. And I mean, if it's trading at a big premium to NAV, then no one's going to redeem. And so our theory behind SPACs is if you don't want people to redeem, announce a good deal and the share price will trade up above NAV. And, you know, that's the easiest formula to success here.
Exactly. And one other thing that I think would be good to reflect on is because of the rising popularity of SPACs is there's been the debate for a while about whether it's more cost effective or a more favorable option for a company to go public via a traditional IPO, a direct listing, or a SPAC. And there's just a lot of confusion here around what I'm hearing from folks in the industry is confusion around carry and other fees. And I mean, just IPO at its baseline, looking at an IPO versus using a SPAC if you're a company wanting to go public. I mean, number one, speed to market. You can quote, if you sign a deal with a SPAC, you can be public within, you know, a 3-month time frame. Whereas if you go on the roadshow, you're looking at 6 to 9 months. But really, there's a lot of confusion on the carry, especially with regards to what pro rata portion of the company, the sponsor of the SPAC, will have after the deal closes. As I keep hearing, the 20% number is tossed around. That's only
20%. Hold on, Mike. And in terms of, just so our listeners are clear, in terms of carry, you mean basically free shares given to the sponsor or founders of the SPAC for doing the deal.
Exactly. It's their incentive for doing the IPO of a SPAC in the first place. But that's where it gets a little bit confusing, because the 20% number that is typical for a SPAC is only on the amount raised in the IPO. And so the market cap of the actual SPAC itself. And so when you combine with, say, a larger entity, that doesn't mean that, you know, if that they're going to have 20% of that combined entity.
Yeah, that's a good point.
And the initial capital raise.
Yeah, so to give you a quick example, for one SPAC that recently announced a deal in which we do have a position in our Accelerate Arbitrage Fund is Fortress Value Acquisition. So they did a $300 million IPO in April of this year, and they just announced a business combination with MP Materials, and the structure results in a pro forma entity with equity value of $1.5 billion. So Fortress Value, their carrier, their 20%, isn't off that $1.5 billion, the equity value of the pro forma entity when the deal is complete. It's actually of the $300 million SPAC IPO, right? And then that's at the upper end of the range. They typically get dialed back on this carry during this business combination, don't they?
Exactly. It's just a starting point. And so it's a starting point that they have at the beginning. Most deals that are done, and I believe there's only been a couple where that carry hasn't been dialed back. And so it's really just something that ends up getting negotiated out anyway. As well, something that's always been talked about has been the fees for investment bankers. I think it's fairly similar in terms of fees for an IPO and fees for, on the whole, a SPAC process. When you look at the SPAC process, the investment bankers, they're getting paid, and I've heard estimates that it's kind of around $20 million throughout the entire SPAC process, but that's based on the average SPAC size, as you had mentioned, Julian, around $300 million.
Yeah, it'd be more like bankers typically take a percentage in IPOs. You kind of see 5 to 7%, but the SPACs have a different structure such that, in my opinion, it ends up with something quite a bit less than your traditional IPO.
Yeah, and where that delta can be either wider or narrower would be, I guess, number one, you have the underwriting fee for the IPO of the SPAC, which is that would be shared amongst a syndicate of banks. But that would be kind of in that 5 to 7% range of the cash raised in the SPAC. But then really where you have that delta that is with the buy side M&A, and that is something that it really depends. That's very deal specific and what the SPAC is able to negotiate with their bankers. And also there's just a lot less clarity on that.
Yeah, and the other thing to consider is when a SPAC is formed, the sponsor put at-risk capital into it, either through the through units, or it's typically these private placement warrants. And so that provides the capital covering basically half of the IPO underwriting fee, and therefore the actual cost to investors, if there's no deal, there's zero underwriting fees born of the investors. If there is a deal, investors are paying like half of the fee out of the actual SPAC because the sponsor is covering the other half. So that's another thing to consider. I saw another criticism, which is that, you know, special purpose acquisition companies, they're doing acquisitions, and acquisitions typically destroy value. And, you know, you look at studies, and typically M&A is value destroying. Obviously, there are certain segments of the market that can do it successfully. I mean, basically, the private equity industry has formed this massive $1 trillion industry on exclusively doing M&A. So clearly, some people can do it and add value. And that sort of criticism on SPACs is just a criticism to all M&A, which really isn't value, or it really isn't valid, in my opinion. Obviously, some can do it well, some can't. But the difference in like a SPAC, they have a higher chance of success than a private equity firm because a SPAC isn't paying a control premium. Meanwhile, a private equity firm is paying that control premium, which is typically 30% higher than the market price. So there's another thing to consider.
Yeah, and one other thing that I did see mentioned was that the only reason that SPACs are becoming a more popular option for companies to go public is because in the pandemic, you're only in this situation, you're only negotiating with one party. So you're negotiating with the SPAC on the deal terms and pricing and whatnot, valuation. But that doesn't really hold a lot of value or hold a lot of weight, in my opinion, just because this has been a trend. Like SPACs have, SPAC issuance has been going up over the last 10 years.
As have quality, so been a, quality yeah, as well.
Exactly. And that's the other thing, is that there's a little bit of a feedback loop where it's becoming legitimized and institutionalized, because you're getting more legitimate sponsors that are launching SPACs, which means more larger IPOs can be done, raising more money. Then they're able to target larger popular companies that many people have heard of, like the potential for Airbnb going public for through a SPAC, or Virgin Galactic, one that has already gone through a SPAC process, that then because of that, you get a lot more legitimization of this a vehicle as an investment vehicle, as well as a vehicle to go public. So there's a little bit of a feedback loop there.
Yeah, some good points there on SPACs. As for what Ackman's going to buy with the Pershing Square blank check company, my three top picks, you mentioned it, Airbnb. He's also really into restaurants, thinking Chick-fil-A could make for a good one. And lastly, one of the biggest unicorn startups out there, Stripe. Those are my top picks. We'll see what happens. We'll closely follow this one, obviously. Now on to some Tesla news. What happened here was electric vehicle manufacturer Tesla, or as Elon Musk calls it, Tesla, it reported a profitable Q2, which marked its fourth consecutive profitable quarter in a row. And what's notable about four profitable quarters in a row at its stage is that makes it eligible for the benchmark S&P 500 index inclusion. And why this is so important is, you know, everyone refers to the S&P 500, the market. It's all that anyone talks about when talking about stocks. Not just that, but trillions and trillions of dollars globally are benchmarked to the S&P 500. So if Tesla does get added to the index, that could spur buying by these index funds that track the index of as much as $50 billion, which is obviously a huge amount. But given the company's historical lack of profitability, combined with stringent index addition requirements, Tesla is not in the index despite its market cap being nearly $300 billion. And it's just absurd in my opinion, because at $300 billion, that makes it the 12th largest U.S. company. And when you think of the S&P 500, typically you would think of all the largest companies would be in there. But that's in fact not true, because at this point, Tesla is not in the index. And really, there's no guarantee, because although Standard & Poor's, the company that runs the S&P 500, they say it's systematic and quantitative in nature in terms of the rules to get into the index, they still have a fair bit of discretion. And so it's more of like an actively managed index, despite what the industry tells you. They say it's passive. It's not. There is a bunch of subjectivity and discretion that goes into it. I got a quote here from Howard Silverblatt. He's a senior index analyst at S&P Dow Jones Indices. He stated, "The purpose of the index is to emulate the U.S. domestic common market. When you go to put a company in to actually select it, it's got to fit into the algorithm in that it represents the market, it has liquidity, it has the size." So there's no guarantee, which is somewhat ridiculous in my opinion. I think if you're running an index, it should be 100% rules-based, not, you know, this index committee making active decisions. So no guarantees there. But I think at the end of the day, Tesla is going to make it into the S&P 500. And if it does, or when it does, you'll have a tremendous amount of demand, upwards of $50 billion, which is probably the reason the stock, or one of the reasons the stock has been absolutely on fire this year, despite a really poor macro environment for auto manufacturers. What's your thoughts on this one, Mike?
Well, first, just to go back to the quote from the index analyst, is if it was true that the S&P 500 was supposed to represent U.S. stocks in general, it would be equal weighted. It wouldn't be market cap weighted, because what you're seeing right now in terms of the index performance, especially on, I believe I tweeted out this week a little chart of like the last 12 months performance of the S&P 500 index, which is market cap weighted, versus the S&P 500 equal weighted index, where the equal weighted index is basically flat on a trailing 12 month basis, where the S&P 500 is up about 10%. Mm-hmm. So that gives you an indication of the top companies are the ones that are responsible for most of the growth in the S&P 500. So it's not just a representation of the U.S. stocks. So that is something that should be clear when looking at the index. But as well, I mean, part like up until now, despite being such a large portion of the overall market capitalization being Tesla with their size right now, I mean, they didn't meet one of the criteria up until now, which was 4 consecutive quarters of profits.
Yep.
That would be the last remaining hurdle for them to qualify. So I'm not too worried about them qualifying for the index. I think they'll highly likely be included in the index once there's another company, because I believe it would be when another company is either acquired or doesn't fit the criteria. At that point, then they would be up for debate for inclusion into the index. But that'll be interesting to watch. And as well, I mean, it's just an incredibly volatile stock. It's yep. down 11% over the last 2 days, as well as Elon Musk himself really got a nice big payday for his equity option grant.
$2.1 billion.
Yeah, the second of 12 performance targets for tranches.
What's crazy is that performance bonus is just based off share price.
Yes, yeah. And like, so I mean, yeah, like Musk is, he is a professional at promoting the stock.
Perhaps the greatest stock promoter of all time, for sure.
Yeah, yeah.
Not to take away some of, like, obviously, I believe Tesla makes some great products. I've never driven one, but they certainly look cool. But certainly he has his detractors, short sellers, and he does a tremendous job. I mean, what other CEO can promote a company and a stock that well? Like, he's one of the most popular out there.
Yeah, when you think of stock promoter, you think of a the traditional in Canada at least, a stock promoter promoting metals and mine micro caps in Vancouver. But no, this is on a scale that has never been seen before. I mean, like, and in terms of their profits, I mean, yeah, the majority of them do come from regulatory credits, which is certainly fair. I mean, it's not like they're. That is anything shady in and of itself, but yeah. I mean, their core business—it's an absolute wild valuation when you look at it at about a third of $1 trillion right now. But yeah, it'll be interesting to watch, and there will be added buying power or buying demand if and when, which I think it's just a matter of when. They get added to the index.
I believe that is one of the major reasons why the stock has rallied so much lately. It's having a astounding share price performance this year. A lot of investors sort of front-running the index, which is one major criticism of passive investing, is that active investors go push around prices, either speculating on an index addition or index deletion, looking to front-run index investors. So that's something to keep in mind. In addition, obviously, highly likely to enter the index. And Elon, man, $2.1 billion payday. Obviously, he's having a great week. Onto some M&A news, some much needed consolidation in the oil patch finally commenced after a brutal, brutal 7-year bear market in energy in the context of really, really constructive equity markets and a highly stimulative environment as well. What happened here was Chevron announced the acquisition of Noble Energy for $13 billion, inclusive of debt. Market capitalization on Noble, roughly $5 billion. So it's a fairly leveraged company. Strategic rationale, this deal boosts Chevron's investments in U.S. shale and in natural gas with Noble's flagship Leviathan field in Israel, so expanding in the Middle East. It's the largest natural gas field out there. And the thesis in oil and gas, I mean, it's been an absolutely brutal bear market. You've seen a ton of bankruptcies, and really there's too many oil and gas companies out there. It appears that Noble's really throwing in the towel, capitulating. They've had enough. They really can't go on anymore. They're selling out for a measly premium of just 7.5%. As we indicated, the typical control premium in an M&A situation is in the 25 to 30% range. So 7.5% is quite slim. And the other thing is Noble stock is being acquired, or Noble selling to Chevron, at the same price it traded at for in 1996, so 24 years ago, with no shareholder value creation. And I wanted to talk about deal dynamics. One deal that we talked about quite a bit on the podcast last year was Occidental's absolutely disastrous $57 billion acquisition of Anadarko, which Chevron famously sidestepped. As you remember, Chevron was in a bidding war with Occidental, Chevron choosing to bow out, showing that they are a disciplined acquirer. And man, that really paid off for them, because Occidental's hurting. They have felt nothing but pain. It was a highly leveraged deal right before the bear market energy got worse and worse and worse. You saw Occidental's share price go from 50-something dollars to sub-10. So it's been a horrific time for them. Carl Icahn, the activist, got involved trying to get the stock back up, trying to get the CEO fired. He was trying to run a proxy contest, kick out the board at one point. So fact of the matter here is Chevron is a very disciplined buyer. And what we're seeing in the market here, if we look at the M&A spread, Noble Energy is actually trading at a 2.4% premium to the consideration. It's an all-share deal at a 0.119 share exchange ratio. And when it's trading at a premium, that indicates that either arbitragers expect Chevron to pay more, or they expect to see another company come over the top and turn into perhaps a bidding war. I'm bearish on that thesis. I don't think Chevron will bump, as we indicated. Historically, they have been a very disciplined buyer, as we saw in the Anadarko precedent. The other thing, I mean, you don't typically see bidding wars in bear markets, right? And we're in an absolutely brutal E&P bear market, the worst oil and gas bear market I've ever seen, worse than, you know, what happened in 2008. While that one was deep, it bounced back pretty quickly. But this one has just been the longest down cycle for a long time, at least the longest that I can remember. So I'm bearish on the thesis that Chevron will bump, and I'm bearish on the thesis that a bidding war will ensue. So I don't think it's worthwhile being involved on this one from a merger arbitrage perspective. Mike, what's your perspective on this much needed oil patch consolidation?
Yeah, definitely agree on much needed. And back to your previous point about whether a bidding war would perhaps transpire here, I would agree that this is a low probability for a bidding war. When you look at the majors, the major E&P or major oil producers, Chevron had, you know, they have one of the strongest balance sheets in the industry, and so it's no small feat to take on Noble's debt, and they are able to do that fairly easily. And the rest of their competitors are worried about like debt covenants, so worried about their leverage ratios, but also worried about their dividends. And you know, for a company like Exxon, who's spent, you know, Chevron spent substantially less than Exxon over the last few years in growing production. You know, companies like Exxon, they're worried about paying dividends and things of that nature. So I think you're quite correct in it being a low probability of a bidding war. Another stat, as you mentioned, the share price that it's basically sat around for 24 years here. But as well, this is also it's a 7% premium to the previous day trading before announcement, but a 57% discount to its 2020 pre-pandemic high, which was on January 2nd. So really not much of a premium. But as well, in other oil and gas news, I did want to bring up that north of the border here in Canada, there is actually a really interesting deal where Kelt was actually able to sell half of their Montney assets to ConocoPhillips, which is, as we know,
the Houston-based company, for $510 million, which also included some assumption of some the debt that was involved with those assets.
And that's actually quite a bit larger than the current market cap of $360 million.
Exactly. It was a great deal for Kelt, as there's been nothing happening in M&A in Calgary.
Zero.
So this is a really big deal, especially because Conoco, being one of the large U.S. producers that is with Canadian exposure, all of their peers, all the other U.S. producers, we've talked about it on the podcast before, they've been exiting Canada. They're selling their assets, and companies like CNRL and Suncor are making some acquisitions. Canadian companies, they're buying the U.S. assets. So this is really where Conoco, because these assets are adjacent to their existing Montney acreage. This is really them doubling down. And as a Calgary resident, I mean, this is a big deal and very positive to see for the Canadian energy sector. So hopefully that will spur some more demand for assets from U.S. producers in Canada. But at the very least, it's just one company that isn't exiting.
I wouldn't hold your breath on that one, Mike. Certainly a head scratcher to see a U.S. company coming back to Canada. As you indicated, they've all been packing up their bags and leaving as quickly as possible. And it seemed to be selling at whatever price they could get for their assets. They just wanted to get the heck out of Canada just because the investment environment was just
and regulatory
brutal.
Environment, right? Like it's a ridiculous regulatory environment.
Exactly.
In Canada. No, can't build pipelines.
Yeah. Yeah. So horrible place to be investing capital. And as they say, capital goes to where it's treated well. Certainly not treated well in the Canadian oil patch. And Kelt investors really can't catch a break here. Despite the huge price, the stock was barely up on the news, but I digress. Interesting deal, as you indicated. And the Chevron Noble deal, it's one that we'll watch, not involved from a merger arb standpoint at currently, just given spreads unattractive. And that's about it for the Absolute Return podcast this week. Folks, hope you enjoyed it. If you did, you can always check out more at absolutereturnpodcast.com. Feel free to leave us a review, recommend it to your friends. Definitely follow us on Twitter. My handle is at Julian Klimochko, KLYMOCHKO. Mike, what's your Twitter handle?
You can find me at M_Kesslering, and you can find not only some overall investment analysis, but also with the NHL playoffs coming back in the next couple of weeks, some mediocre hockey coverage as well.
Ooh, great. Go Jets. And to all the investors, listeners, short sellers, we wish you all the best in your trading and investing this week, and we will chat with you soon. Bye, everyone.
Thanks for tuning in to the Absolute Return Podcast. This episode was brought to you by Accelerate Financial Technologies. Accelerate, because performance matters. Find out more at accelerateshares.com. The views expressed in this podcast are the personal views of the participants and do not reflect the views of Accelerate. No aspect of this podcast constitutes investment, legal, or tax advice. Opinions expressed in this podcast should not be viewed as a recommendation or solicitation of an offer to buy or sell any securities or investment strategies. The information and opinions in this podcast are based on current market conditions and may fluctuate and change in the future. No representation or warranty expressed or implied is made on behalf of Accelerate as to the accuracy or completeness of the information contained in this podcast. Accelerate does not accept any liability for any direct, indirect, or consequential loss or damage suffered by any person as a result of relying on all or any part of this podcast, and any liability is expressly disclaimed.